This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. During World War II, Nazis looted some 600,000 artworks from Jewish families. Many have ended up in museums, and restitution for families can be rare. That's what makes Maria Altman's case so special. Nazis stole 6 paintings by the Austrian artist Gustav Klimt from her family home in 1938. Decades later, she asked a family friend to help her recover them, and after an 8-year legal battle against the Austrian government, E. Randall Schoenberg did just that. On September 27th, he'll talk about the case in the inaugural Nancy and David Wolfe lecture at Union Terminal. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about the fight to recover those stolen paintings and the implications for the legal and art worlds are lawyer and genealogist E. Randall Schoenberg. Welcome, Randy.
Hi there.
Cincinnati Art Museum curator of European paintings, sculpture, and drawings, Peter Bell. Thanks for being here, Peter.
Nice to be back, Lucy.
And Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law professor of law, who is of counsel at Rottenberg Lippmann Rich in New York, Jennifer Crater. Welcome, Jen.
Thanks, Lucy.
The Cincinnati Art Museum and the Nancy and David Wolfe Holocaust and Humanities Center are financial supporters of Cincinnati Public Radio. Peter, as I mentioned just in that introduction, more than 500,000 pieces of art were stolen by Nazis during World War II. Talk about the impact of that on the art world and how many are still hanging in museums and galleries today.
Well, the scope of looting and coerced sales was just absolutely massive in the 1930s and during the war. And the Nazi apparatus had all sorts of different ways of separating artworks and cultural patrimony from its rightful owners within Germany and then around Europe as they moved through the continent. There are still thousands and thousands of artworks that are missing or lost or destroyed, but also many that as you alluded to do still exist and are in the wrong hands. So it's been a long process as the other guests on the line can talk about to try to bring artworks back to their rightful owners, the descendants of their owners. And it's work that very much continues.
Yeah. Randy, you're best known for your work helping Maria Altman, your family friend, regain possession of those paintings that Nazis stole from her family home. Talk about that. I mean, how you got involved with the case, just what that took to really make that happen.
Well, I got involved because Maria, as you mentioned, was a very close family friend. I used to joke that she knew me since my mother was in diapers, because her husband Fritz and my mother's father, Eric Zeisel, were friends already in Vienna. And so both families managed to escape the Nazis in 38 and 39 and made their way to the United States and ended up in Los Angeles, where they reunited and they both had kids in the meantime. And so my mother really grew up with the Altmans as very close friends. By the time I came to work on the case, Maria was sort of the last one left of that generation. And it was just an amazing experience for me to be able to help her out, because not only would we talk about the fascinating facts of her family and the paintings, but then she would also tell me stories about my grandparents and my great grandmother and things like that. So it was really a labor of love for me.
Peter, let's talk a little bit more about these works by Gustav Klimt. At least one of them is quite well known. Was the subject of a major motion picture that I will reference in a little bit. Tell us a bit about Gustav Klimt and his style of artwork, what these paintings represent.
Klimt is probably one of the best known Austrian artists of all time. He was active in the sort of 2 decades around the turn of the century. He died in 1918, but he's best known for this extraordinary decorative painting style that is closely associated with some of the new art movements around 1900, Art Nouveau, And the secession movements in Europe, in which artists sort of rebelled against the sort of strictures of academic teaching in how they made art. And in Klimt's case, that resulted in these extraordinary patterned almost symbolist style works, both in terms of portraiture, landscapes, and you know, in fact, in sort of Raumkunst, in sort of art that would envelop the viewer, not just the traditional modes of easel painting.
Randy, talk to us about your impression of the painting that everyone knows the most about, and also just about the case itself, how difficult it was to you know, get these paintings back to their rightful owner.
Yeah, well, the woman in gold, as it's known, is the portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, who's Maria's aunt. And there are actually two brothers who married two sisters. So it's both Maria's mother's sister, but also Maria's father's brother's wife, right? So she's sort of a double aunt. And I remember going to Vienna for the first time as a teenager or 11-year-old, and then as a teenager, and we would go into the famous museum there, the Belvedere, which is an old Habsburg palace that's filled with all of Austria's best art. And my mother would point to this painting and say, you know, your grandmother's friend Maria, that's her aunt Adele Bloch-Bauer. So I knew the painting, but I had no idea what the story was behind it. And it was only in 1998 when Maria called me. Austria had passed a new law that was designed to return artworks that had not been properly restituted after the war or had been donated in quotes in exchange for export permits after the war. Austria had had this sort of extortionate procedure after the Nazi period where they didn't allow Jewish families, the survivors of Jewish families, to take the artwork that was recovered and export it out of the country. And so they extorted donations. And that's really how these paintings got into the Austrian collection. They were stolen during the war. And then instead of returning them, the Austrians kept them in order to allow the family to get other things out. And so when this all came to light, thanks to an amazing journalist named Hubertus Czernin, who did incredible research and wrote a whole expose on this, the Austrians, to their credit, passed a new law allowing for the return of this. And that's when Maria called me. And initially, we thought they might be returned under the procedure set up by this new law, but then the Austrians decided not to do that. I think when they passed the law, they didn't realize that it would cover these very famous and important paintings. And so they decided to hold on to them. So Marie and I had to decide what to do. And the law firm I was working at was not so interested in filing lawsuits against foreign countries. I left the law firm, went out on my own. And the first thing I did was I filed a complaint against Austria. And it was called Maria Altman versus Republic of Austria. And that case, I think everybody, Jen, you can confirm this, I think everybody was sure that I was going to lose. But miraculously, at the district court level, we won. And then Austria appealed to the Ninth Circuit. And we won there. We won just the right to do the lawsuit initially. And then the U.S. government intervened and against us and tried to get the case dismissed. And the case ultimately went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, where again, everybody was certain that we would lose. And I was certainly not overconfident either. But I argued in the U.S. Supreme Court for the first time on this completely crazy case for my grandmother's best friend, trying to recover paintings that had for 60 years been hanging in this Austrian museum. And by some sort of miracle, we won in a 6-3 decision, and the Supreme Court gave us the right to proceed with the case. At that point, the case had been going on for about 6 years already. Ultimately, Austria offered to do an arbitration of the issue in the case, which was whether the paintings should have been returned to the family after the war, or whether under the will of Maria's aunt Adele Bloch-Bauer, who had died already in the 20s before the Nazi era, whether the Austrian gallery would be entitled to keep them. And so we went back to Austria, which was sort of a leap of faith. Maria wasn't so sure that we should do that, but she trusted me, and I went very naively back to Austria to argue this case in front of three Austrian judges. And amazingly, again, we won. All three judges agreed with our position, which was actually the same position about the will that Maria's father had taken. He was a lawyer in the 1920s, which was that Adela Bloch-Bauer's will requesting her husband leave these paintings to the museum was really a non-entity. It wasn't binding. And so the paintings should have been returned, but of course they weren't returned after the war, and therefore under the new law, they had to be returned. So 6 years after beginning, it went from 1998 to 2006, these five of these amazing Klimt paintings, including the famous Woman in Gold portrait of Adela Bloch-Bauer, were returned to Maria Altman and her family. And that was an amazing and unexpected result. And really, I sort of still pinch myself today to think that I could have been a part of it.
And when Randy was doing that, you were really so far out there on your own, because the other big case that was proceeding at the time was the seizure by the U.S. government of the Portrait of Wally painting by Egon Schiele, who was a friend of Gustav Klimt, so in Vienna. And so Randy didn't have the backing of the U.S. government. He mentioned that the U.S. government had filed a brief against his claim. And so while all that was happening, one of the things I was working on was all of the different class actions for slave and forced laborers in Germany and people who were victims of being transported on the trains, and people who lost insurance policies and were being asked for death certificates in order to get them paid out. And then you had the Swiss bank litigation, and everybody thought that the lawyers who filed those cases were going to lose too. But just in Germany, the foundation paid out $8.8 billion, I believe. And so Randy's case was going forward, and the executive agreements that dealt with, they're sort of like treaties between the United States and various European governments, had an express carve out for art. So everybody was watching Randy's case go up to the Supreme Court, as well as what was happening with Portrait of Wally, and looking at also some of the dollar values of these paintings. And so they were not covered by these new governmental agencies set up to pay out to people in the class action. So everybody who wanted to recover art, they were truly on their own. And, you know, few people were able to get the government to back them. But at the time, Randy was not backed by the government and still won.
I want to remind our listeners, we're talking in this recorded interview about the legal quest to recover art stolen by Nazis, a story that was told in the movie Woman in Gold. Jen, did what Randy did, this approach that he took, did this create any kind of roadmap for other lawyers who were representing clients who'd had art that was stolen or taken by coercion?
Yes, in a way, but it also showed everybody just how hard the fight would be to get back things that were really of significance culturally. So, you know, even today, there are still cases going on, but more of them are being settled in mediation or arbitration, usually quietly. And there's definitely a different level of resistance when you're dealing with a painting that's beloved by the museum goers in a certain city. And, you know, I think maybe the judges are a little reluctant to want to be the ones to take that away from people as well, you know, whether they really realize that or not. I think it's sort of shocking to people that paintings that they know and love have this history.
Randy, you mentioned, you know, this was a fight against the Austrian government. It took years and years to get the resolution that you got. What did this mean to Maria Altman to have the outcome that she got?
Maria was quite elderly at the time that it finished. She was 90 years old. And she was, of course, ecstatic to have won the case, but not so much for herself, but I think for her family. And my favorite part was when we brought the paintings very quickly out of Austria, and we had them on display in the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And they were just in one room. It's just five paintings, but that's how they were initially. Maria always, when she told the story, said, we used to go over to my uncle's house and he had a memorial room for his wife who had died relatively young in the 20s. And it was always fresh flowers in the center and then these beautiful paintings around. And so they replicated that in the museum. And there was Maria with her four children, her grandchildren, her nieces and nephews. And she had become a real hero to her own family. And for me, that was just an amazing thing to see. And I was just so grateful that I could do that for her.
Peter, what different approaches have museums and galleries taken to address this problem, this injustice? And what would it mean for museums and galleries and the public if all of these stolen works were returned to the people they were stolen from or their heirs?
Well, at the same time that that Randy was starting this legal battle, late 1998, there was the Washington conference. The U.S. State Department convened a conference on Holocaust-era assets in late 1998. And the result of that, the Washington conference principals sort of had signatories from 40 odd countries around the world, you know, stating that they would, you know, through their own national processes try to address Nazi confiscated art. Here in the United States, because you know, most of our museums are nonprofit, are private institutions, not governmental institutions, we are sort of governed by our professional associations, the Association of Art Museum Directors and the American Alliance of Museums. And at that same point in 1998-99, those organizations published guidelines. So in order to be, you know, be in these associations, museums have to take certain steps to make their collections available for research and accessible so that any potential claimants out there would have as easy access as possible to see if there are works of art in public collections that shouldn't be there. So that's how we've done it. You know, there are a whole range of other ways that this issue has been and is being tackled in Europe, which has very different you know, museum systems in general. But it's, you know, it's been so long now since many of these works changed hands during the war and during the Nazi era, that we continue to lose access to information, to people that can, you know, really put their finger on what paintings, you know, they remember in their grandparents' houses. So it increasingly becomes the work of the archives and of, you know, enterprising people in the legal profession. But it goes on, and I think that the main thrust now and should continue to be is for museums, public institutions to really put out as much information about works of art that have an incomplete provenance. Mm-hmm. Provenance is just the word that we use to talk about the history of ownership of an artwork. And if if there's any question about who was the rightful owner of an artwork between 1933 and 45, then, you know, we should be flagging that. Those works should be, you know, available for the public to study, even if they aren't on view on our walls.
Hmm. Randy, I mentioned earlier the movie Woman in Gold. It tells the story of how you got these paintings back for Maria Altman. It's got Ryan Reynolds starring as you and Helen Mirren starring as Maria, a really terrific movie. It kind of implies, though, that you didn't have an appreciation for genealogy or family history much before this case, which I know is not correct. How important is your passion for genealogy in this work that you do? related to art law, even?
It's a good question. Obviously, you know, you say you can't believe everything you see on screen, although they did do a pretty good job.
Well, I mean, you look just like Ryan Reynolds, clearly. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, thanks so much. Genealogy really prepared me to do a case like this because I had been already interested in my own history, which of course the same as Maria Altman's. All four of my grandparents escaped the Nazis and were from Vienna. And as a result, I was familiar with how to do research. I had learned German to understand more about them. And so all of that work that I had done really just dovetailed right into this type of research that I needed to do and the work I needed to do for Maria Altman. But as you know, my work has always been there and then continued even after that case genealogically. And now I have a new documentary film that I put together last year. And I'm so happy it's going to have a sneak preview in Cincinnati.
Yeah. Why was that? I know your documentary is Fioretta about your passion for genealogy. Why was that story so important for you to have told?
It was genealogy has always been really important to me, but I never really thought that anybody else might be interested. But I was talking with my cousin Serena, who is Italian. My dad's sister married an Italian composer, and so Serena lives in Venice. And I was telling her that I think I could trace our family back 500 years to a family that actually lived in Venice, a Jewish family that was there at the founding of the ghetto, the first ghetto in Europe, in Venice, Italy. And she's an artist and has made films. She said, "Oh, Randy, that would make an interesting film." And so I mentioned it to a high school friend of mine who was putting together another documentary. And I said, you know, my cousin has this idea. And he and the director, Matthew Mershori, thought, wow, that really could be something. And so we kept talking about it and they really wanted to do it. So we did it. We went to Europe and I dragged my teenage son, Joey, along and the story became a lot about him also, which is fine. And we, the genealogy is really just sort of the skeleton or framework for it. It's really a story, a family story of discovery and searching. And we find the people who are able to lead us to the next step up the chain, 15 generations back, 500 years to this amazing family in Venice, about which there is quite a lot known. And so it's a little bit, I think of it like Homer's Odyssey, where we go to each island and meet the monster at each island, and there's a story about that. And so it's, I hope, entertaining for people. And so far, when we've screened it, people like it. But it's just about to be premiered at the Woodstock Film Festival. And 2 days earlier, we're doing a sneak preview in Cincinnati, which is my wife's hometown. And so I'm really happy to be coming back for that.
Oh, I didn't realize your wife was a Cincinnati person. That's a great connection.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. She went to Walnut Hills and her father also. She's from a big Cincinnati family. So I'm hoping a lot of them come out to the events, both my talk at the Museum Center and then at the Marymount Theater on the next day, Wednesday and Thursday.
Well, that's great. See, you even knew to mention the high school. Well done. I've been talking with lawyer and genealogist E. Randall Schoenberg, Cincinnati Art Museum curator of European paintings, sculpture, and drawings, Peter Bell, and Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law professor of law, who is of counsel at Rottenberg Lippmann Rich in New York, Jennifer Crater. E. Randall Schoenberg's talk will be September 27th at Union Terminal, and Marymount Theater will have an early screening of Fioretta, the new documentary about Randy's passion for genealogy, on September 28th. You can find more information about both events on our website. Thank you all so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.